everybody to Under the Spotlight. Theater in Ecclesiastes, and we're going to learn from Laura today how Ecclesiastes can be developed and made more meaningful through the theater arts. Is that pretty accurate?
Yeah.
Good. Laura was one of our artists in residence and is back with more fun things to share with us. This session is being recorded, so know if you participate in the fun, you too will be recorded.
Did I say a waiver?
Thank you for coming.
Thanks, Lori. Thanks everyone for coming. Also, I mentioned this to a few folks, but there are Bibles out there. If you want to run out and grab one, you don't have to have one. And there's some paper up here if you want to jot anything down. But yes, we're going to talk about theater in Ecclesiastes, Under the Spotlight, like under heaven.
Okay. Do you want the lights off?
Can you guys see this?
Yeah.
Okay, great. I think we'll turn it off in a little bit because I'm going to show a video. But yeah, so we're going to talk about this. So I was here as an artist in residence from the end of February until mid-April about. And I am a theater artist and writer, and I also do my day job regular in environmental studies stuff. So that's what I was going to come back and talk about. And then I was talking to a good friend of mine who has taught theater at Jewish summer camps for a long, long time. She's an amazing theater artist and works with kids. And I was like, oh yeah, I'm going back to Holden. I'm going to talk about theater, comedy, ecology. And I was like, oh yeah, the theme versus Ecclesiastes. And she looked around and she's like, Ecclesiastes? Because it turned out that she had spent a month last summer teaching theater in Ecclesiastes to middle schoolers at this Jewish summer camp that she works at. And so she was like, here are all my materials, oh my goodness, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, oh, this is really interesting. So I like looked at her stuff and thought, well, let's see what happens if we talk about this here in our context.
So this is her PowerPoint.
This is her PowerPoint. I took everything. I'm just going to memorize it. No, this is different. So really the idea is that the themes of Ecclesiastes are found all over and in our theater arts as well. So we're gonna take a look at that. So here we have a lovely theme verse. Volunteer to read this out loud.
For everything there is a season, and a time for every matter under heaven. Time to be born and a time to die. A time to plant and a time to pluck up what is planted. A time to kill and a time to heal, a time to break down and a time to build up, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance, a time to throw away stones and a time to gather stones together, a time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing, a time to seek and a time to lose, a time to keep and a time to throw away, a time to tear and a time to sow, a time to keep silence and a time to speak, a time to love and a time to hate, a time of for war and a time for peace.
So just to start, what are some structural patterns you notice about how this is written? Anything that jumps out at you?
They seem to say in the beginning of like a sentence something more, not always more positive, but there always seems to be opposites, a positive and a negative. Or something that we would like to do and something we would rather not want. So.
Yeah. And other things. These can be very obvious things. They don't have to be super complex. Yeah.
It's a time 2222222224.
Yes. There's a lot of repetitive language, and it's kind of this like, this happens then this. There's before and after or a cycle happening that we see there. Anything else about the structure of this?
I've always thought it was interesting that sometimes the good thing is first and the bad thing is second, and other times the bad thing is first and the good thing is second.
Yeah, I noticed that as well.
Don't know why.
Yeah, so now, are there things about this that draw questions to your mind, or you're kind of like, I don't know, like this part is like confounding to me in some way, or I don't quite get a certain part of this. Yeah.
Well, I guess more of just a comment that it just seems more, I guess I don't know if I want to say the reality, but the one that kind of surprised me the most was a time for war and a time for peace. I guess maybe just the acknowledgement that maybe sometimes we have to go to war. I don't know. I just found that kind of interesting, I guess. Surprising.
Yeah. That question is like, is there a time that this is supposed to happen?
Right. Because all these other ones, well, except for A Time to Kill, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah. Other things that are either disconcerting.
So, I don't know if anybody really cares, but it's Bastille Day 2 days from now. And one of the things that I usually do at Holden is read It Was the Best of Times, It Was the Worst of Times. And that repetitive thing is called an anaphora. When you do a time two and then the four. That passage does the same thing as Ecclesiastes, is it takes the dark and the light and the dark, and it pits them against each other and sets up tension. And you know, it's like what you were talking about, but that over and over again it does that. So you're not sure. I mean, it the good and the bad just sort of all of a sudden seem to take on something else. Something that we might say would be normally bad or not a good thing might be possibly good in the right case. So, I don't know.
And I've never read it as condoning the negatives, more as acknowledging that they exist. Mm-hmm. It's almost an acknowledgement of our sinful nature.
Or acknowledgement of the inevitable?
I suppose, given that we are all sinners,
that sounds a little bit almost, that's a positive or hopeful take on things that, you know, we're allowing ourselves to live in a space where these things happen. Any other things that are maybe helpful to people or anything at all?
Yeah. Well, I was able to do a reflection on this piece, and so that, you know, I was able to study it prior to that. And I found that for me it was enjoy the times of love and peace, because tomorrow we might be at war, or tomorrow, you know, you might break your leg or whatever. I don't know. Something might happen. And so, you know, there might be a time to laugh today because tomorrow I might have something to cry about.
Right.
Or vice versa.
Well, so we have never volunteered to read from the beginning of Ecclesiastes. Anyone wants to read a couple verses?
Got you.
Right. There will be some continued participation. All will be voluntary, but just so you all have a heads up, we read 1-5.
Yeah. Everything is meaningless. The words of the teacher, son of David, king in Jerusalem. Meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher. Utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. What does man gain from all his labor at which he toils under the sun? Generations come and generations go, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun sets and hurries back to where it rises.
Great, thanks. So that's pretty fun. Everything is meaningless. This is the New International Version, and in this translation, it's translated as meaninglessness. But in other translations, in NRSV, it's vanity, and it can also be pointlessness, which is something that Kent mentioned to me yesterday. But the Hebrew word means like something that's fleeting or vapor. So this was a conversation that my friend and I had. She had talked to a lot of like Hebrew scholars who were at her camp about how they were translating this word, and they also had a lot of different opinions on how it should be translated. And if it's meaninglessness, pointlessness, if you want to use the actual word vapor, things like that. So this is my like 2 second summary of the rest of Ecclesiastes, which is that a lot of it is wrestling with the teacher, who's the person who's writing this, is going, what is the meaning here? Is everything pointless? What else is going on in the world? I don't know. And then you have this in the third chapter, and there are 12 chapters total. So this is toward the beginning, but a lot of it is trying to figure out like what's going on here? I don't know. Everything seems meaningless. So could I have another volunteer to read? Exactly. Will you read 13 and 14, just the very last two?
Now all has been heard. Here is the conclusion of the matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment, including every hidden thing, whether it is good or evil.
There we go. So that's the very end of the book. It's like, well, let's respect God, and there we go. And it's pretty short, at least when I was reading this, I was like, are we getting to something here? And then it's kind of like the last two verses are like, oh, I guess that's the conclusion. There's God, and, you know, fear him. Great. So, yeah, it's a lot of wrestling. So now we're going to talk about theater and how theater wrestles with some of those same questions, how it uses some of the same devices, the literary devices that we see in this Ecclesiastes passage. So we're going to talk about realism and absurdism and musical theater, our three different types of theater, that all kind of approach these questions in different ways. So we're going to start with realism. Chekhov is our main person that we're going to talk about. Have people heard of Chekhov before? Maybe read or seen The Seagull as Chekhov, Three Sisters, Uncle Vanya, and The Cherry Orchard, all that.
We're not talking about Star Trek, right?
We're not talking about Star Trek.
So I declare.
A Russian playwright from the late 1800s. And basically, this came about because before this, a lot of theater was like Greek theater where there are masks, or Shakespeare where everything is very dramatic. And his response was to go, let's put real life on stage and see how that works and have this natural theater. It was also supposed to be theater more for the middle class, that was something you could see your life on stage. And yeah, so we're going to read a little excerpt from Three Sisters, which is written in 1901. So I'm going to need some people who would like to read. I need four volunteers. It'll be very short. Okay, Zach, Lauren, and Catherine, come on up here. This is your stage right here. So here's the summary of Three Sisters. Is there are three sisters who live in Russia.
So we have a brother.
And then, and we have another. Wow. Casting worked out incredibly. Okay, so Lauren, you're going to be Alina. Lori, you're going to be Masha. Would you like to be Olga or Chubrykin?
Oh, Zach, Olga, Koga.
Yes! Catherine, you're going to be Chubrykin. I think that's how you say his name. I wish he was Russian. Great. So, Three Sisters is a play. It's about three sisters and their family that used to live in Moscow. Now they don't live in Moscow. They all want to go back to Moscow. But they can't go back to Moscow. There's all this stuff happening. People are in love with each other in different ways, with these soldiers that live near them and all the other folks. There's all these power struggles that are kind of happening with different people marrying into the family and the sisters not feeling like they have their space anymore and stuff like that. So this is the very last scene of the play that you're going to hear. And most of the play before this is just, they don't say a lot of their feelings necessarily. It's kind of, they're acting like they would in real life, where they maybe won't be like super direct with each other or things like that. But this is the very last scene of the play. So, let's see if it starts. Go for it.
What is it? Tell me quickly. What is it? For God's sake! The Baron has just been killed in a duel. I am worn out. Let them cry. It doesn't matter.
I can't do this. You don't have to do the stage directions if you don't want to.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, listen to the band. They are going away from us. One has gone altogether, gone forever. We are left alone to begin our life all over again. We've got to live. We've got to live.
The time will come when everyone will know what all this is for, why there is this misery. There will be no mysteries. And meanwhile, we have got to live. We have got to work, only to work. Tomorrow, I shall go alone. I shall teach in the school, and I will give all my life to those whom it may be of use. Now it's autumn. Soon winter will come and cover us with snow, and I will work, I will work.
Music is so gay, so confident. One longs for life. Oh my God, time will pass and we shall go away forever. And we shall be forgotten. Our faces will be forgotten, our voices, and how many there were of us. But our sufferings will pass into joy for those who will live after us. Happiness and peace will be established upon earth. And they will remember kindly and bless those upon earth. And they will remember kindly and bless those who have lived before. Oh dear sisters, our life is not ended yet. We shall live. Music is so gay, so joyful, it seems as though a little more and we shall know what we are living for, why we are suffering. Only we knew. Only we knew.
Tarabum, dear. Doesn't matter. It doesn't matter.
If only we knew. If only we knew.
Jumped out at you either in general from what they were talking about or anything that kind of struck you as like, oh, this maybe brought up something that was similar to what I was thinking about with the Xenosis. I can read it.
I liked the line about our misery is a mystery, but we have to keep living. Just work to work.
Yeah.
That felt very Ecclesiastes to me.
Yes.
Yeah. A new season has come. It's like throughout the play, I think it's like winter time, and it's transitioning. Something new.
Yeah.
To look forward to.
Yeah, that's a good, a lot of it of the play too has to do with the seasons and how they're dealing with this whole winter and if it will ever be spring and kind of like the spring in their lives as well.
There's kind of the optimistic and the pessimistic. Just different reactions to, I assume, the same set of circumstances, obviously.
Plays, characters also wrestle with that idea and they like might that might be something that's on their mind. The second response to this idea of meaninglessness is this idea of the leap of faith, which is where you go, okay, life here seems meaningless, but I believe that there is something outside of here. I believe perhaps it can be, you know, it is religion, it is Christianity, Judaism, Islam, whatever you may have, that's where your meaning comes from, is outside of it. And then the third response is that life is absurd, so the way for me to feel fulfilled is to completely try to embrace that absurdism and try to understand it. And some philosophers say that's what you're going to do, and that's what this art is trying to do, is to like live in this absurd way. And other philosophers said like you're going to drive yourself crazy if you try to do that, because it's so complicated. And these tensions are so complicated that are similar to these tensions we see in Ecclesiastes of like time to kill, time to live, like how do we find the space in between? So absurdism uses a lot of repetition, as does Ecclesiastes. So we're going to watch a little clip from Waiting for Godot. This is a play involving two characters who are waiting for an invisible person that we never meet, named Godot. And they continually keep forgetting who they're trying to, like, what they're doing. There are two other characters that meet them, and they're in this desolate landscape. So I was also trying to provide some context to this scene, but really the only thing to say is that, like, they're still waiting. So that's what's going on. These are our two friends. So that's our little Waiting for Godot clip. And now we're going to do some Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead, so I need two more actor volunteers. Okay, me and Marge, take a look at this. Come on up. Okay. I'm going to be Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. I'm going to give us some context. And just one thing for you to know, this like one love two, that's like tennis. So you're keeping score.
Okay.
And it's like one love three. So they're playing this game. So these two, so Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead is from 1966. It's kind of the same type of play as Waiting for Godot, where there are these two characters who are trying to remember what's happening and they can't ever remember. And this play takes place behind the scenes of Hamlet. Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are two actual characters from Hamlet. And this is like what would be going on. You're watching the play Hamlet and this is going on behind it, kind of. And so they're trying to like find Hamlet. They can't remember who told them what to do. And the play starts with them flipping a coin that only ever comes up heads. And this is, they're trying to pass the time, and they're having a competition with each other. They're playing the question game, I believe, to try to pass the time.
Aren't Rosencrantz and Guildenstern their ghosts in Hamlet, right?
No.
No?
They're two guards who are kind of, they're minor characters, but at the very end, they are killed. So they're kind of like Hamlet's friends, but they really don't appear very much in Hamlet itself.
Right.
Okay.
So maybe listen for some things that they might be talking about. There might also be questions that you would come up with. You're thinking about the themes of Ecclesiastes. All right.
We could play at questions.
What good would that do?
Practice.
Statement one, love.
Cheating.
How?
I hadn't started yet.
Statement two, love.
Are you counting that?
What?
Are you counting that?
Foul, no repetitions. Three, love. First game to...
I'm not gonna play if you're gonna be like that.
Who's sir?
Ha!
Foul, no grunts. Love, one.
Who's? Go.
Why?
Why not?
What for?
Foul, no synonyms. One, all.
What in God's name is going on?
Foul, no rhetoric.
Two,
one.
What does it all add up to?
Can't you guess?
Were you addressing me?
Is there anyone else?
Who?
How would I know?
Why do you ask?
Are you serious?
Was that rhetoric?
No.
Statement, two all game point.
What's the matter with you today?
When?
What?
Are you deaf?
Am I dead?
Yes or no?
Is there a choice?
Is there a God?
Foul. No non sequiturs. Three, two, one game all.
What's your name?
What's yours?
I asked you first.
Statement, one, love.
What's your name when you're at home?
What's yours?
When I'm at home?
Is there a difference at home?
What home?
Haven't you got one?
Why do you ask?
What are you driving at?
What's your name?
Repetition. Two, love, match, point to me.
Who do you think you are?
Where That's the question.
It's all questions.
Do you think it matters?
Doesn't it matter to you?
Why should it matter?
What does it matter why?
Doesn't it matter why it matters?
What's the matter with you?
It doesn't matter.
What's the game?
What are the rules?
Great. Things that you thought of while they were talking, things that jumped out to you.
I think both the absurdist plays are just kind of condensed versions of what definitely happens all over the place in regular life, but because you condense it to such a degree, the absurdity just like flares out really blatantly.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, that's a great way of putting it. Uh-huh. Yeah. Other things.
They talk about everything being meaningless right at the end there, mm-hmm. which is the Ecclesiastes.
And these, they're definitely, they're more willing and they're written in this way where the characters are allowed to ask very big questions without very much introduction. Like, who do you think you are? Do you think it matters? Why should it matter? Doesn't it matter? Like, what's the, is there a God? Is there a choice? Things like that, that they're just bantering back and forth, just throwing it in there. So that's, a fun thing about absurdism, also a strange thing about absurdism, is throwing those questions out there. And then, like you saw in the repetition in Waiting for Godot, sometimes it can be humorous too, so like Monty Python is a good example of absurdist humor, and how, you know, things can be just back and forth and strange and not really make sense. Yeah. Any other thoughts about this that don't have?
It is nice that they bring humor to such giant questions. And I wonder if that's how Ecclesiastes is supposed to be read as well.
What was going through my head was a memory of the old Who's On First?
Yeah.
I mean, it really had that same ring about it, although the questions in the Rosencrantz, the Guildenstern piece, were much more significant than the Who's On First.
Yeah, that's interesting just from like a literary standpoint, seeing how they use that type of structure to talk about these big questions. Yeah, mm-hmm. And some people say that these two characters and Tutu Away for Godot are like Laurel and Hardy, kind of these slapstick vaudeville kind of guys. And I think there was a production of Waiting for Godot that was Steve Martin and Robin Williams as the two guys. So that's kind of the fun way to see that series. Great. So all this is really just like kind of meant to be something that you can put in your toolkit as you're living your life. You go, oh, I'm thinking about things. What else can I look at to help me, you know, think about the big questions of life? So now we're going to talk about musicals, and so basically in musicals, characters sing when their emotions are too strong to just be speaking them. They have to use song to like really get it out there. And then a lot of songs in musicals are about what a character wants, or how they want to be, who they want to love, you know, what they want to know, things like that. So we're going to listen to two songs. One's from Hamilton, one's from Rent. Hamilton, if you haven't heard, around the grapevine is like the biggest hit on the block. And it's the story of Alexander Hamilton, but it's told with hip-hop and rap music and kind of like the music of our time. The composer wanted to take the story of the Founding Fathers and portray it with music that people today listen to, and portray it with a cast that looks like America today. So the cast is mostly African-American people of color and some white folks, but back. So we're going to listen to a song that's sung by Aaron Burr's character, where he's trying to figure out, like, he kind of wants to beat Alexander Hamilton at, you know, being the big guy around the block, and so the song is called Wait For It.
It's called what?
Wait For It.
Yeah.
of the chorus is this over here. In the second column, the depth doesn't discriminate. Part. Yeah. Anything that jumps out to you about this? Thoughts?
I guess this is a time to die. It's funny, but I mean, death doesn't discriminate. So I'm guessing they're implying that, you know, we all eventually die, and there's a time to be born.
Yeah.
Do they say anything about being born? I think so.
And then it switches the second to, on the far right-hand column, it switches to life doesn't discriminate to the Seventh-day Saints, which is interesting. Like, it's kind of this, he's wrestling with this idea of, you know, you can be good or bad, and this happens to you anyway. Anything else?
It's a good example of pointlessness.
Right. Now, one more song. This is the final song of the musical Rent. It's Love Heals. So the musical Rent is about being in a city where many folks are experiencing AIDS, and friends and communities figuring out how their relationships work because of that, and how they're going to live their lives in light of this disease that's affecting them. But this is the last song. It's called Love Heals, and might be a little more hopeful.
Oh,
talk to you for this one.
How is it different or similar to the things we've looked at before?
I felt an Ecclesiastes thing. It said, when you reach out your hand and only wind is there.
Even though this song doesn't get at it directly, you can kind of take from it that it's saying love is what is able to transcend the meaninglessness. If you have love, then it doesn't really matter if things are meaningless around you.
Yeah,
it certainly seems that way. Yeah. One more thing. There's some pieces of paper up there. We can just pass them out to everybody and give you a pen. There's some pens up there.